I was at a dinner the other night, and two of the people at the table were just kind of marveling about the fact that they're like, God, I thought I understood. I thought I knew J.D. Vance. I mean, I don't think I can think of somebody who's had as dramatic and rapid a transformation in his reputation in Washington over the course of the last few years. Before he was in office, but when he was just a kind of, you know, an author, there was this feeling that, oh, this guy could go in a lot of different directions politically. And to see him now as the most slavish lapdog for Trump, it's just the kind of thing that comes up a lot at dinner tables these days. Yeah.
Have you been to any good dinner parties lately? Because I have. And man, it is all anyone can talk about is J.D. Vance. Really, that's how you know you're at a good dinner party, if that's what people are talking about. Anyways, welcome back to the New Yorker political scene. I'm your host, Russ Finkelstein, and we will get back to Evan Osnos and company at the New Yorker political scene shortly. But first, I wanted to talk about something else that was in the news recently. And that is CNN anchor Dana Bash was recently protested at an event for her new book that's just been published. She was shouted at by pro-Palestinian activists, and I think rightfully so. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably aware of Dana Bash's pro-Israel bias. But regardless, these protesters were very quickly smeared as anti-Semites. Dana Bash's colleague at CNN, another anchor, Jake Tapper, tweeted, "These protesters target Dana at her home and this event because she's Jewish. There's nothing about her coverage of the Israel-Hamas war that is different from most other news coverage covering both Jewish/Israeli and Palestinian pain. This harassment is anti-Semitism." Now, in the Jewish Forward, which is a Jewish American magazine that's also pretty hardcore Zionist, their article described the event by saying, "Bash was repeatedly interrupted by several masked young women who stood up and delivered prolonged rants before bookstore security escorted them out. Quote, 'You belong behind bars. We know who you are,' screamed the first protester. 'It is not a war. It is a genocide. You are complicit in the genocide.'" Honestly, spot the lie here. As security moved that protester out, another one rose and shouted, "You call yourself a good journalist, tell the truth." She added, "You want millions from Zionists, you want millions from AIPAC." A spokesman for the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC confirmed in an email that AIPAC has no financial connection to Bash and has not paid her anything. Of course, the article goes on to quote the Anti-Defamation League CEO Jonathan Greenblatt, who tweeted that it is, quote, "unacceptable to hurl such anti-Semitic bile and false accusations against a Jewish American journalist." Anyway, if you have the displeasure of having watched as much CNN as I have, you know that even though the mainstream media is largely biased in favor of Israel and in favor of Zionism, there is something different about Dana Bash's coverage of the war, contrary to what Jake Tapper would have you believe. And I will say, standing out as a staunch Israel defender at CNN is saying a lot. Of course, the list of Dana Bash's dishonesty is far too long for me to recount here, but I'm going to go over a few of the lowlights just to refresh our memory. One of the first instances that comes to memory for me was in the immediate aftermath of the October 7th attack. Dana Bash interviewed the former U.S. ambassador to Israel under Joe Biden, Tom Nides, and had to give this remarkable disclosure.
Joining me now to talk about the war in Israel is the former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Tom Nides. We should disclose that he is married to CNN executive vice president Virginia Moseley.
So yeah, even if you do make this disclosure, do you expect the audience to believe that you're prepared to ask really tough questions to your boss's husband? Then, of course, there was her interview with the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal.
I want to ask you about sexual violence. And it's kind of remarkable that this issue hasn't gotten enough attention globally.
Dear listener, I promise you now, as well as when this interview took place, the issue has gotten a disproportionate amount of attention.
Widespread use of rape, brutal rape, sexual violence against Israeli women by Hamas. I've seen a lot of progressive women, generally speaking, they're quick to defend women's rights and speak out against using rape as a weapon of war, but downright silent on what we saw on October 7th and what might be happening inside Gaza right now to these hostages. Why is that?
Now, there is at least one account that I know of of a former Israeli hostage, saying that she was sexually abused and tortured while being held by Hamas in Gaza. And I don't really see much reason to not believe her. But her story was published in March of this year, and that interview with Pramila Jayapal took place last December, when the Israeli embassy to the United Nations was pushing a largely debunked story that Hamas used systematic sexual violence in the October 7th attack. And of course, there was a lot of overlap between the sourcing for that Israeli story that got pushed at the United Nations and the New York Times article that has also been widely debunked, screams without words, that there were so many journalistic issues with. Basically, no one believes it anymore.
Israel is a democracy. That is why they are a strong ally of ours. And if they do not comply with international humanitarian law, they are bringing themselves to a place that makes it much more difficult strategically for them to be able to build the kinds of allies to keep public opinion with them. And frankly, morally, I think we cannot say that one war crime deserves another. That is not what international humanitarian law says.
Okay, with respect, I was just asking about the women, and you turned it back to Israel. I'm asking you about Hamas, in fact.
I already answered your question, Dana. I said it's horrific, and I think that rape is horrific, sexual assault is horrific. I think that it happens in war situations. Terrorist organizations like Hamas obviously are using these as tools. Mm-hmm. However, I think we have to be balanced about bringing in the outrages against Palestinians. Yeah. 15,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes, three quarters of whom are women and children.
And it's horrible, but you don't see Israeli soldiers raping Palestinian
Well, Dana, I think
women.
We're not...
Of course, it's the very end of that clip that's aged the worst, because now we do know about Israeli soldiers who have been arrested and charged for gang raping a Palestinian detainee at a detention camp in Israel. And it was actually a CNN report that first exposed all of the abuse that was going on there. Now, beyond what's come to light about the gang rape of a Palestinian detainee in this Israeli military facility, maybe the most horrific development of all is that lots of prominent Israeli political leaders and members of Netanyahu's government have defended these soldiers, and there is an instance where mobs of protesters led by politicians stormed into this military facility to free the Israeli soldiers who were arrested for committing this gang rape. So not only did Dana Bash's remark that you don't see Israeli soldiers raping Palestinians age horribly, what's even more stark is the contrast between her underlying assumption that such a thing would never take place with the fact that it does take place, and by and large, it's acceptable in Israeli society to celebrate it. Just horrific, disgusting stuff. And then there's this insane montage that Dana Bash used during the student protests across the United States in the spring. I played this clip on an earlier version of this show, and I'll play a little bit of it again to refresh your memory.
We start with destruction, violence, and hate on college campuses across the country. Many of these protests started peacefully with legitimate questions about the war, but in many cases, they lost the plot. They're calling for a ceasefire. Well, there was a ceasefire on October 6th, the day before Hamas terrorists brutally murdered more than 1,000 people inside Israel and took hundreds more as hostages. This hour, I'll speak to an American-Israeli family whose son is still held captive by Hamas since that horrifying day that brought us to this moment. You don't hear the pro-Palestinian protesters talking about that. We will. Now, protesting the way the Israeli government, the Israeli prime minister, is prosecuting the retaliatory war against Hamas is one thing. Making Jewish students feel unsafe at their own schools is unacceptable, and it is happening way too much right now.
It was accompanied by a tweet from Bash that says, quote, "Today, destruction, violence, and hate overtake college campuses across the country, with Jewish students feeling unsafe at their own schools. It is unacceptable and hearkening back to 1930s in Europe." So there she is, Dana Bash, comparing nonviolent student protesters to Kristallnacht-era Germany. But anyway, going back to that Jewish Daily Forward article about Bash and the incident at her book event, the Jewish Daily Forward writes, "A spokesman for the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC confirmed in an email that AIPAC has no financial connection to Bash and has not paid her anything. Anyway, I decided to do a little bit of my own research. And it's funny because in that interview that Bash did with the former Israeli ambassador back in October, she had to disclose that he's actually married to an executive at CNN. What AIPAC's statement about Bash didn't tell you is that her husband used to work for AIPAC. Here's an article about him published in The Guardian in 2022. Biden intelligence advisor previously vetted deals for Israeli NSO Group. A former senior CIA official who was recently appointed by Joe Biden to an intelligence advisory board previously served as a key advisor to NSO Group, where he vetted deals for the Israeli spyware company and voted on whether sales of the controversial hacking tools could proceed. Jeremy Bash served on NSO's Business Ethics Committee. Interesting, ethics. Where he was instrumental in giving advice to the company on whether proposed sales by the Israeli group to specific foreign government clients would be seen as acceptable to the U.S. government, multiple sources familiar with the matter said. Bash is believed to have served as an advisor to NSO through a parent company called Q Cyber from about 2017 to 2020, but his firm declined to confirm the dates. The article goes on to explain how Bash was being vetted for his new role advising the White House, the Biden White House. And The Guardian says that this arrangement, quote, could prove awkward for the Biden administration, which placed NSO on a U.S. blacklist in November of 2021 after concluding the company had developed and supplied software to foreign governments that used the tools to, quote, maliciously target government officials, journalists, business people, activists, academics, and embassy workers. Now, I'm not saying that Dana Bash is necessarily responsible for the crimes of her husband, but I do think that that fact check from AIPAC that says that Dana Bash has never worked for them doesn't necessarily pass the smell test if it doesn't also disclose that her husband used to work for AIPAC. This is from an article published in October of 2023 in The Lever. It was written by Andrew Perez and Lucy Dean Stockton. The world witnessed a modern high point of the American presidency when President Joe Biden visited and spoke in Israel on October 18th amid its brutal assault on the Gaza Strip. At least that was the take offered by Jeremy Bash, national security analyst for the liberal cable news network MSNBC. At no point did MSNBC mention that Bash, who served as a chief of staff at the Central Intelligence Agency and the Department of Defense in the Obama administration, leads a consulting firm that has reportedly worked for defense contracting giant Raytheon, which supplies missiles for Israel's Iron Dome defense system. Bash has close ties to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, the powerful pro-Israel lobbying group. He was previously a staffer for the group and emceed portions of its annual policy conference in 2019. Again, this isn't like 30 years ago that this happened. This wasn't something he did when he was out of college. He emceed an event for AIPAC as recently as 2019. The article goes on, quote, "This is my 29th AIPAC conference," Bash said to cheers from the audience, before interviewing several lawmakers about their support for legislation designed to provide more security assistance for Israel and support states' efforts to limit economic boycotts against Israel. Speaking with Senator Kyrsten Sinema at the event, Bash said, quote, "You and I first met at an AIPAC event in Arizona a couple of years back. You know how important it is that AIPAC educate candidates who are running for Congress or running for office, because the minute they are sworn in, they may have a vote to take that impacts Israel." Again, I don't necessarily believe that the transgressions of Jeremy Bash on their own completely erode the journalistic credibility of his wife, Dana Bash. I just think in the swamp that is the internet, when these things happen, like Dana Bash gets protested at her book event, and people say it's an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory to accuse Bash of working for AIPAC, it's worth knowing that her husband not only worked for AIPAC, but was a top official in the CIA and worked for an Israeli security company. Of course, this is all relevant information that neither Jake Tapper, nor CNN, nor the Jewish Forward, nor the Anti-Defamation League, nor AIPAC want you to know. But it does make me feel a little bit less insane to be able to unpack that for you. Now, if you're a regular listener of this show, you know that what I usually do here is unpack and respond to the political analysis of Evan Osnos, Jane Mayer, and Susan Glasser on the New Yorker political scene. Now, just timing-wise, I'm in a bit of a tough spot this week because their episode is a sort of preview of Tuesday's debate. Now, here I am recording this Monday night, and in all honesty, it took me a bit longer to fully flush out that Dana Bash segment that I just did. But it was fun, and I'm glad I did. Which means, A, I don't have that much time to spend on this week's political scene episode, and B, there's probably diminishing returns on doing that anyway, because some of you might be listening to this on Tuesday before the debate, but just based on the analytics that I've been seeing, a lot of people listen to this podcast 2, 3, 4 days, even a week after it comes out. So if it's okay with you, I'm going to do a sort of lightning round on the New Yorker political scene's debate preview. But I'm sure next episode we'll have plenty of time to discuss what actually happens at the debate.
One of the things that I found memorable from her earlier debates was in her performance with Pence when he was patronizing her. And she said,
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking. I'm speaking.
I think she has, you know, really figured out how to deal with a guy who's trying to dominate her that way. And I'll be very curious to see whether she can do this with Trump.
You know, that idea of I'm speaking, which is essentially really a big kind of philosophical declaration, I'm taking up space here in this public place, is a really big, important idea. And you see it on T-shirts, for instance, among her supporters. It's people consider it larger than just a rhetorical technique.
And of course, it's one of the rhetorical techniques she's wielded more recently against Palestinian protesters when they interrupted her at that rally in Michigan and she said, I'm speaking. Since the convention, it's become clear that the Harris campaign doesn't seem to give a damn what the pro-Palestinian activists think, so maybe they will lean into it more and keep putting it on their merch, even though it's a reminder to a giant faction of her base how she's leveraged her identity to defend her support for an ongoing genocide.
Critics have mocked her a lot, though, over the years, her public performances and for her sort of homespun quotes, like the one from her mother, you know, do you think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
My mother used to, she would give us a hard time sometimes and she would say to us, I don't know what's wrong with you young people. You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
Evan, you've watched her for a while. Do you think her style has changed? Has that criticism had an effect on her?
No, I actually, to the contrary, I think that that quote unquote criticism has actually proved how out of touch a lot of those people were who thought, ah, we've got her. She's laughing in public. Well, it turns out actually a lot of Americans were happy to have a president or a presidential candidate who could laugh.
So I guess some people might have been taking issue with her laugh, which if you take issue with the substance of what she's saying does come across like a bit of a cackle. But what I've seen in terms of negativity in response to these viral clips is that she says sort of kooky and loopy shit, like a wine mom on Xanax. Now this particular phrase that they play there in the clip, I actually love that phrase. You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you. To me, that sounds like some good old-fashioned Marxist materialism, and I'm here for it. And there was a moment where it seemed like a lot of people on the actual left were really excited about the Harris campaign, in part because of these clips. Of course, the hosts of the New Yorker political scene are only able to see it as a quote-unquote homespun, folksy saying, but I do really like the philosophical substance of it. Kamala Harris's mom, from everything I gather, seems pretty cool. But again, what I see people taking issue with when it comes to these viral clips is her social awkwardness and that laugh that seems to sometimes be a nervous response to discomfort, especially if she's talking about something sad. The laugh can come off as out of touch.
Is the United States willing to make a specific allocation for Ukrainian refugees? And for President Duda, I wanted to know if you think and if you asked the United States to specifically accept more refugees.
Okay. A friend in need is a friend indeed.
Okay, I confess.
But the other thing that's striking when you go back and exhume the history here a little bit is that Donald Trump is often gives these coherent wild man performances in debates, that, you know, the sort of polite commentary that says, oh, my God, that was terrible. He lost. He's lost on points almost every debate he's ever had, in fact. And yet he emerges as a political winner often in ways that are kind of hard to quantify and to talk about.
Fuck, it's like such a tired point to make It's been 9 years since Donald Trump emerged on the political scene, and people have pointed to professional wrestling as a prism through which to understand him and what makes him attractive as a public figure. Like, just go read any number of think pieces about this. It's really not that hard. The guy is a heel, and there are a lot of people in this country who are just excited to see him break all the rules and then bash the referee in the head with a folding chair.
Well, an institutional obligation, actually, that I should remind our listeners that The New Yorker this time is going to be doing a live blog of the debate. So Vincent Cunningham and Claire Malone and I will be reacting in real time and trying to keep each other sane.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's something to look forward to. Evan Osnos and company will be writing a live blog during the debate. I'm probably going to get stoned and watch the debate. As I've said before, I love debates. I'm excited for this one. I think it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be funny. It will probably also be disturbing and depressing, I'm sure. But as I've said, I have very low expectations in terms of what our politics is able to produce in terms of material benefits for my life. The one thing I can count on is spectacle. And America certainly is very good at creating spectacle. Maybe even the best. So that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next week for what I'm sure will be very astute analysis from the New Yorker political scene about this historic debate.
The Industrial Revolution, to me, is just like a story I know called The Puppy Who Lost His Way. The world was changing, and the puppy was getting bigger. So you see, the puppy was like industry. In that they were both lost in the woods. And nobody, especially the little boy, society, knew where to find them. Except that the puppy was a dog. But the industry, my friends, that was a revolution. Nib High Football rules!
Mr. Madison, what you've just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.